welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for, well, it's once again Saturday, June 11th, 2016. It's just after 5 UTC as I'm starting to record this. I'm Sam Minter, and once again we have no Yvonne Bo. So we tried to get it together several times this week and didn't quite manage. Yvonne, has a whole bunch of family stuff going on, basically. I'll leave it at that. But he's been preoccupied and unable to join me on the couple of nights we attempted. Well, one night we were trying to attempt it and he couldn't do it. And the other night, by the time I was free, it was after midnight East Coast time, and he still had stuff going on anyway. So it just didn't work out. And once again, I was unable to get any volunteers on a last-minute basis to join me. So you've got me, and just me, on this week's Curmudgeon's Corner. So some of you who don't like that, that's your fair warning. Jump out. Join us again next week. Our agenda is going to be fairly typical. I'm going to talk a little bit, well, probably a lot, about the election. We'll start out with the Democrats, and then we'll talk about the Republicans, and we'll probably throw in a bit about the Libertarians and Greens as we go along. And then I have a random smattering of other issues on my list if we get that far. But let me start by saying, I'm tired. I said it's a little after 5 UTC. Where I am on the West Coast, it's actually Friday night around 10 p.m. I tweeted about this, but, this week I had two, like, normally, I've got a fairly normal work schedule, but it's also a fairly relaxed work environment where I can be flexible and I change things around based on what's going on that day and whatever my family needs or childcare. So I'm not a morning person. So I generally don't start work very early, and I try to actually go a little bit later to avoid the morning rush hour because it makes my commute that much worse. But this week, for Thursday, I somehow agreed to a conference call, including some people in Europe, and being on the West Coast of the U.S., that is challenging time zone-wise. It makes it so that you're going to do something early. But it wasn't just a conference call. I had, like, people in Seattle that were going to join, too, so I had to go in person. And it was at 6 a.m. our time on Thursday, which meant that I had to wake up between 4 and 4:30 and drive. So I was, Thursday was a really early morning. And, I'm not a morning person, but I am a nighttime person. So I wasn't in bed until after midnight. So I had like 3 hours of sleep on Thursday. And then, by the way, we all get there to the conference room and are about to dial into the call when I noticed that at about 2 a.m., they emailed to say they couldn't make it. Yeah. And now that's rescheduled for next week, so I have to do it again. And then on Friday, I also had, it was only an 8 a.m. meeting, and I was going to do that by phone, but then I got scheduled for like a meeting shortly after that was in person. So I had to go in person for the 8 a.m. meeting, but to avoid traffic, I went in a little bit earlier. I ended up at the office at 7. So, I am not a morning person, but yet I ended up in the office at 6 a.m. on Thursday and 7 a.m. on Friday with both days just a few hours of sleep, really. I mean, 4 hours one day, 5 hours the next, whatever. And yeah, so I actually I intended to record this episode essentially as soon as I got home from everything on Friday night, but I took a little bit of a nap first. But anyway, I'm still tired. I still should just be in bed because usually I'd sleep in on a Saturday, but I've got Saturday morning stuff to do too, so I have to be up at like 7:30 again. So. Oh, the travails of being me on a odd week. This is not a normal week. But anyway, that's it. I don't like mornings. If I did not have a work schedule, if I was completely determining my own schedule, if I did not have to take my son to school or anything like that, I would very rapidly shift into a schedule where I wake up at noon or later, and then I stay up all night till about sunrise and then go to sleep. You know, because I remember the good old days, and I know my clock has probably changed since I was, you know, in my late teens, early 20s, but that certainly was where my body gravitated at that point. I probably wouldn't quite do exactly the same thing today, but I still have this mental image that that's what's comfortable for me, is that kind of schedule. But the reality of, you know, being an adult with a job and a kid and everything else is that that doesn't happen. Nothing even remotely close to that happens. There is a schedule that you have to stick to, and I have not had a vacation long enough to even try to revert to an unscheduled schedule in ages. Just wanted to gripe about that for a little bit, especially the one that was canceled. You know, I got up at 4 in the freaking morning to drive in and be at work at 6 in the morning, and there was no meeting. Of course, I just stayed and, you know, did the rest of my day. And both Thursday and Friday, I ended up leaving a little bit earlier than I would otherwise, but whatever. Anyway, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back. And dive into the election stuff, and we'll start off with the Democrats. Back after this. And I'm back. After that last segment, some family stuff happened and I ended up going to sleep. So it's indeed Saturday morning, and to continue my string of being a morning person, I am recording at 6:30 in the morning because I've got other stuff going on this morning and I wouldn't get the podcast out in time if I didn't wake up early. I've been up since, at least half an hour before actually starting. So am I turning into a morning person? That 1-6 a.m. meeting that I talked about before is rescheduled for next week, so I'm going to have to do it again, and there's another day with an 8 a.m. meeting. I don't know who they took and replaced me with. There are too many mornings going on here. Anyway, time to talk about the Democrats. Of course, the number one thing is Hillary Clinton did clinch the nomination. As they did with the Republicans, the AP went out and called a whole bunch of superdelegates and got a bunch of them, mostly off the record, to say that, yes, indeed, they were going to vote for Clinton, which pushed the count over to edge before the last big batch of states voted. So my count on election graphs took another 24 hours or so to get there when New Jersey closed the polls. Almost instantly, everybody's count had Hillary Clinton over the limit, and by the end of the night, well over the limit. And there you go. I mean, we've been talking practically since January about how this was essentially inevitable, absent a miracle. In February, there was some chance that if Sanders swept the first few states, maybe it would change the dynamic, but that didn't happen. And from that point forward, I've said, you know, even if you're really generous to Sanders, once we got past Super Tuesday, the real Super Tuesday, not like CNN saying every Tuesday was a Super Tuesday, the beginning of March, from that point forward, it's been the scenarios that would result in Sanders catching up and winning were just increasingly outrageous. It was clear it wasn't going to happen, unless Clinton was found murdering puppies in her backyard or something like that. You know, it wasn't going to happen. But the interesting thing, and I included this in my post about Hillary Clinton clinching on election graphs, is just how much a significant portion of the Sanders supporters have not just been, you know, we're hoping for a miracle here, we know we're going to lose, but we're fighting on for the principle of it and to get influence in the platform and to change the Democratic Party, blah, blah, blah. But who really, honestly, and truly believed that Sanders could win up until the last moment or beyond. There's still people right now that are still talking about scenarios for Sanders to come back and win, even though Clinton is over her magic number. Because, of course, she's over the magic number, including superdelegates. And that will probably still be the case after D.C. votes. It will still be the case. No probably about it. It will still be the case going into the convention that if all of the superdelegates, or even less than all, I did a quick calculation that if you assume she wins all of the superdelegates who have not yet expressed a preference, all expressed a preference for Sanders, and this calculation is a few days old, it's probably different by now, then she'd need about 25-30%, I forget the exact number, of the superdelegates to flip in order to make Sanders win. So it's not even 100%, you know, if you add in those the undecideds, you know, but it's still a huge number. So you would need that sort of, you know, something massive happens to Clinton in order to have that in play. But there's still some people out there who are like, it's going to happen. She's going to be indicted. They're going to abandon her en masse and blah, 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 blah. Yes, there are scenarios where that can happen. There, you know, are scenarios where somebody who hasn't even been running could win the Democratic nomination, you know? But they are so far out there and require, you know, sort of unforeseen events, let's say, you know? I mean, we really are talking things along the lines of Hillary Clinton has a heart attack and is incapacitated. Or the killing puppies thing, or something else. Would have to be something that all of a sudden that even the Hillary supporters were like, yeah, no, we're done. We've been supporting her for many, many months, and we really believe in her, but no. It's not going to happen, kids. It's not going to happen. And every time I see the Sanders dead enders, I'm like, really? Now, this is separate from the should he continue to run through the D.C. primaries in a few days. You know, I said, look, you know, in 2008, Hillary went through the last elections to give everybody a chance to do her support. I think that's fine for Sanders to do. I think that's absolutely fine. I'm not one of the ones who say because Sanders didn't drop out after the day that Hillary got, you know, to the magic number, that Sanders is doing something wrong and divisive and blah, blah, blah. No. It's fine to go through the rest of the primaries. It's fine to even, like, you know, quote unquote, stay in until the convention. But the self-delusion that there may be a scenario that you win, that is just unseemly. It's like, come on, look, face reality, you know? Now, there have been mixed reports. There have been some that say, you know, this is coming straight from the top. This is coming straight from Sanders. He really thought he could win. Maybe he really still thinks he can win. There are others that say, come on, Sanders knows. Sanders completely knows. But to be a viable candidate, you have to continue to say, we're going to win right up until the end. And there's some truth to that. There's some truth to that. And we've talked before about the, well, what does Sanders want at this point? And I think, you know, he's got a pass to go through D.C. After D.C., the longer he hangs on, the less of what he wants he's going to actually get. And, you know, what he wants could potentially be changes to the rules, changes to the platform, you know, commitments from Hillary to say certain things about certain issues, etc. And, you know, I told Yvonne a few weeks ago on the show, you know, Sanders is going to get exactly what Clinton wants to give him. No more, no less. She is in a commanding position here. And yes, he's got a bunch of supporters who are angry and noisy, but, you know, I'm not convinced Sanders, you know, can really necessarily bring them along anyway. It may have some of them enough, but, you know, just judging from the reaction when Elizabeth Warren, endorsed Clinton this week, you know, just imagine once Sanders endorses Clinton, which he almost inevitably will. If he doesn't, you know, he's just squandering what he's done so far, I think. But, you know, there have been posts saying, you know, look, what he wants is not even about these specific things in the platform, et cetera, or whatever. It's about the movement and continuing the and having the Democratic Party recognize that support of progressive ideas is a very important part of the Democratic constituency, and that they have to reckon with that going forward, and that the party as a whole is moving to the left, and blah, 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 blah. My honest thought on that is, well, maybe. And there's certainly some, you know, demographic indications of that, and that might be the case. You know, Sanders supporters have, however, been overwhelmingly white. And he, one of the things he never really cracked is being able to get the support of non-white communities, and they are growing faster than the white community. So I'm not sure, you know, demographically how that plays out over the next few years. But one thing that I am sure of is that with Clinton winning the nomination and likely the presidency, Clinton's view of what Democrats stand for and what Democrats want to do will be the predominant one. If she wins the presidency, she is the face of the Democratic Party for the next 4 to 8 years. Not Sanders, not a Sanders, you know, stand-in supporter type person. And also, you know, Sanders has been concentrating very strongly simply on the presidency. One of the areas he's thrown his weight behind a few primary challenges to Democrats in the House and Senate, but he hasn't really focused on Congress or local races or anything else down ballot. That's one of the things he was sometimes criticized about, is not supporting the Democratic Party as a whole. So this does seem like a movement that, while yes, there are issues behind it, is very focused on this one guy. And guess what? This one guy lost. And somebody else is going to be in charge. When Hillary wins, the Congress is going to be, and the Democrats in Congress are going to be behind her. You know, when people complain about the superdelegates being overwhelmingly for Clinton, you know, a good number of those are the Congress people. So the Democratic Party, the public face of it, is going to be Clintonite. And I don't think Sanders is going to change that. What I see happening here is the people who are really excited about Sanders coming out of this being jaded about politics and thinking it's pointless, and that, you know, they were really excited and look at this, and then the system took it away from them or whatever. And those people actually becoming less engaged, not more engaged going forward. Now, there is the possibility that they get mad about this and become more engaged and get really organized for 2020. And maybe they do a primary challenge for Clinton in 2020 or something like that. Or maybe they do start organizing on the local and state level. I don't know. That could happen. I think it's less likely. I think what is more likely to happen here is that the people who are really engaged with Sanders, because it ended up being a loss, disengage. And next time around, think it's pointless and don't bother. Because, you know, look, we put all of this time and energy and effort in 2016, and we got nothing. So why are we going to do it again in 2018 for Congress, or 2020 for president, or 2022? You're shaping the views of a generation of young, yeah, because we're mainly talking about the young Sanders supporters here. And, you know, we'll see. But, you know, for the folks who are thinking that, you know, the Sanders uprising represents a permanent shift in where the Democratic Party is going, I'm really not so sure. It's possible. But I wouldn't bet on it at this point. So that's it for Clinton and Bernie, I guess. excuse me. it seems like I wanted to say something else about that, but it's slipping my mind. If it comes back, I'll let you know. In the meantime, we do have Clinton's Veep search. And the most prominent person talked about this week is, of course, Warren. You know, people are very excited about the possibility of a Warren vice presidency. There are all kinds of reasons why it might not happen. People have talked about the chemistry between Clinton and Warren not really being there. They've talked about the fact that if Warren leaves the Senate, a Republican governor of Massachusetts gets to pick her replacement in the Senate. And if they're really working on trying to pick up the Senate this year as well, that's not going to help. There are other reasons as well. Warren may be having more influence in her current spot in the Senate than she would as a vice president. Warren maybe not being all that good as a second fiddle. All kinds of reasons have been talked about why this is not a possibility, and why, and even the fact that there would be two women on the ticket. And does Clinton feel that we're ready to do that? You know, despite sort of, you know, a number of people have responded, hey, we've had plenty of cases with two men. Why would two women be bad? And that's absolutely correct. But Clinton is very cautious about these sorts of things, and would want to have really good data on the fact that this would help her, not hurt her. And if it would hurt her, she might think twice about it. Anyway, the one thing I tweeted was that the one thing it looks like, and appearances may be deceiving, but Warren certainly looks like she wants the job. She's been very active in attacking Trump. She's been probably the most prominent elected Democrat, in terms of how she's been directly taking on Trump, mostly over Twitter, but also in some speeches. And Trump has been reacting very negatively to it, and she's clearly getting under his skin. And that's got to be something that Clinton would want in a VP. And it really kind of seems like an audition. You know, Warren is very much acting like she wants the job. And the pick would certainly get the base of the Democratic Party, including a lot of Sanders supporters, potentially excited about the race with that combination. Now, as I mentioned earlier, a whole bunch of Sanders supporters are going nuts over Warren endorsing Clinton, saying she's a traitor and she's not a real progressive and blah, blah, blah. And okay, fine. There will be folks of that type. But I think the majority of Sanders supporters would actually be excited by Warren being added to the ticket. I don't know if it'll happen. I don't know. I'm rooting for it at this point, actually. Like, I think that would be a really exciting combination to look at. I like Warren's attitude towards a bunch of things. I haven't looked deeply enough into her individual positions to tell you which ones I agree with and which ones I don't. But I like the way she approaches things, the way that she's sort of like, look, this is what I think it's right, and I'm gonna push forward on that, and I'm gonna stick it in your face, and I'm not gonna like hide behind convention. Some of the stuff she's done, with the banks, et cetera, sort of bringing up uncomfortable facts directly to people's faces and saying, no, we are going after that. You're doing something wrong, and something has to happen, as opposed to sort of sweeping it under the rug. I like a lot of that out of Warren. And I think that would be an exciting combination. And going up against someone like Trump, having that two-woman combination, I think would be perfect. I think that's exactly the right way to counter Trump, is not to have your, old white male on the ticket. You want to have that contrast be incredibly sharp, and I think Warren would do that. There may be a few other people who would do that, but Warren would certainly do that. And meanwhile, like if Trump goes and picks Gingrich or something, you couldn't have a starker difference between the tickets than Newt Gingrich and Donald Trump versus Elizabeth Warren and Hillary Clinton. I mean, now, this goes directly towards, well, what's Clinton's strategy going to be in the general election? Is she going after that median voter and trying to pull some independents and Republicans on her side, or is she really trying to energize her base? So far, the indications are she's going the standard go after the median voter strategy. In her big foreign policy speech where she attacked Trump and that was the main headline coming out of it, she also very much was staking out the centrist to even a little bit on the right ground in national security in terms of how the country should be involved. She's not doing the peacenik angle or anything like that. That's not Hillary. That's not what she does. So far the indications are she's doing the thing where she's trying to pull Republicans who are unhappy with the Trump choice over to Hillary, as opposed to energize the base. And that means she's going to try to emphasize centrist credentials, not progressive left-wing credentials, because she feels like the left might not like it, but they're going to vote for her anyway, at least almost all of them are, because they don't want Trump. I think that's a reasonable way to look at it. But she could also kind of do both. Do that kind of thing with her her positions on individual issues, and say, look, I'll be reasonable on this issue. I'll work with Republicans on this issue. I'll work with the reasonable Republicans, not the Trump guys, but I'll work with the reasonable Republicans because Trump is a nutbag that you can't trust and can't be in charge of anything. But you know, there are a few reasonable Republicans left, and I'll work with them on these issues, blah, blah, blah. And she can do the triangulation kind of thing her husband made famous, while at the same time appointing Warren to vice president and saying that she's going to have, you know, significant role in administration. She's not going to be a figurehead vice president. She's going to be involved. She's going to have things that she's in charge of. She, you know, give some indication of which kinds of things you're going to rely on her for, that kind of thing. I think she might be able to have this both ways. And we'll see where that goes. We'll be back. I think that's all for the Democrats. One more thing to mention on that is I've heard a number of people in sort of Sanders world are talking about, we're going to Jill Stein. We're going to support the Greens. Is this a major factor? I don't think so. In the national polls and the state polls I've been looking at, Jill Stein is still low single digits. There's not a significant amount of support there. And the polls of third and fourth party candidates tend to end up showing numbers that are significantly higher than the actual votes they get in November. So I don't think Jill Stein is going to be a factor. I think there's a chance that Johnson will be a factor. He's running a little bit higher in the polls than the Libertarians typically do. Some up and some down, but he's averaging around the 10% mark in national polls. He's averaging around the 6% mark in the state polls I've been looking at. But that also tends to fade as you go on. But this is the kind of election where if things go right, maybe it doesn't fade. So it's a little early to sort of say we are in the exact same typical pattern where the third parties are a non-issue. This is exactly the kind of election where, you know, the majority of Americans don't like either of the two major party candidates, where third parties could do better than they normally do. I'm not saying that they're going to be competitive to get electoral votes, but they might be strong enough that they can tip the balance in some states. We'll see how that goes. But even among Sanders supporters, if you look at it, I'm looking at one Survey USA poll, and this is honestly the least favorable to Clinton of any poll I've seen so far of Sanders supporters. Most other polls I've seen have shown the number of Sanders supporters that will go to Clinton being in the 70% range. This one is a Survey USA poll that was released, I guess, Friday or Saturday this week. Friday. It was released Friday. Clinton, 41%. This is of Sanders supporters, where nationwide, where they plan to go. 41% Clinton, 15% Johnson, 11% Stein, 7% Trump, and 13% plan to stay home. Clinton still has the largest group there. Johnson is doing better than Stein. These third parties together, Johnson plus Stein is 26%. Yeah, that's not a tiny number. And 7% going to Trump is not tiny. But you still have the plurality sticking with Clinton. And I think history has shown in these sorts of situations that at this stage in the race, a large is sort of the maximum number of people saying they won't come around and go to the person who actually won. And then that diminishes as we get closer to the election. So we'll see how that is. I should also say that that same Survey USA poll also polled what happens if Sanders runs as a third party. Now, leaving aside the fact that it's probably actually too late to do that in any significant way, he gets 18%. and comes in third. With him in the race, Trump wins nationwide, according to that survey. With him out of the race, Clinton wins. So the effect of Sanders running as a third party is in that particular poll gives the election to Trump, which is kind of what you would expect. Now, of course, nationwide poll isn't how it works. It really works by electoral college. To really analyze that, you'd want to do state-by-state polls and understand what's happening there. But chances are what would happen is that in a handful of states that were close, Sanders would basically act in the Nader, Florida kind of way and push the state from Clinton to Trump. In Sanders' best case scenario, maybe he wins a couple of states. Maybe he wins Vermont. Maybe he wins a couple other of the states where he was really strong in and the Republicans are really weak. If he wins enough of those, you end up throwing the election into the House. The House has to choose from the top three winners. The House votes by state, not by their normal delegations, which means that even if the Democrats have an amazing year and take back the House, by state delegation, it's highly likely that the Republicans might still be in charge. In which case, they still elect Trump. And let's say the state delegations are Democratic. It seems unlikely, but are they going to pick Sanders? No, they're going to pick Clinton. But most likely the result of Sanders running as an independent is to make it harder for Clinton. And in the case where Trump is otherwise able to hold it close, maybe even give the election to Trump. So, which is probably not what Sanders voters really want. So those things aren't going to happen. Sanders has said repeatedly he's not going to run for a third party for exactly that reason. I don't think there's going to be such huge numbers of Sanders supporters going to Stein that's going to make a difference either. Between Stein and Johnson having sort of a higher than normal percentage of I don't like either of them, maybe that'll make a difference in a couple of states. But I don't think it's going to be a huge factor. We'll see. I could be wrong. It could be Johnson and Stein making the difference in the election. With Johnson pulling some folks from Trump and Stein pulling some folks from Clinton. But then maybe they mostly wash themselves out, although Johnson's consistently looking stronger than Stein. Okay, enough about the Democrats. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back. We'll talk about the Republicans, specifically Trump's really, really awful last couple of weeks. Back after this. Okay, here I am again. First of all, just to mention, in that last segment, I said quite a few times if Sanders was going to run as a third party. At this point, if Sanders was going to run, he'd of course be running as an independent, not as a third party, because there's no party there that he would be the head of, unless he did a last-minute bid to take over the Greens at the Green Convention in August. which I guess is possible, but I don't know how that would run. But anyway, he said he wouldn't do that. Republicans, Trump. So Trump doubled down on the stuff about the judge since we last spoke. He was getting hammered by numerous Republicans who, including many who had already endorsed him. The most typical, of course, or the sort of prototypical, that's what I wanted to say, is Ryan, Speaker of the House, who said that Trump's comments were basically the definition of racism and denounced those comments, but then said, of course, I still support it. Because it's, you know, and his rationale is he's still going to do more to support the Republican agenda than Hillary Clinton would. Okay. You know, it's one of those things where, to many of us, those kinds of comments and those kinds of behavior are just an instant disqualifier. It's like, I don't care anymore about anything you say about any issue whatsoever. You are now disqualified. You know, you're not even on in the realm of possibility because you've put yourself beyond the pale. But to many people, that's not the case. It's still, you're balancing this against a whole bunch of other things. And those other things are more important to you than, you know, what this guy is blathering on about showing his bigotry. But, you know, it's been stunning how many people sort of pushed back a little bit and were like, I can't believe I endorsed this guy. We haven't really had a lot of unendorsements. We had one, I guess, Senator Kirk, who's a Republican senator in a blue state, who is listed as the endangered, I guess, most endangered Republican senator. But for the most part, there hasn't been a lot of that. However, there has been a lot of there has been an increased amount of talk of Trump has to get it together. Trump has to tone this stuff down, or there are going to be problems. Like, okay. And so we had a couple, you know, Trump gave a couple speeches on teleprompter. That one on the night of the last Republican primaries and caucuses this Tuesday, and one since then at some conservative event, I forget which, where he was basically a lot more staid and in control. He was reading off a teleprompter. It was prepared remarks rather than his usual just, I'm going to rant for an hour. And while those comments were a lot more in control and normal and, you know, maybe not completely normal, but they were a lot more staid than his usual. And you saw some people sort of applauding. Oh, look, yeah, there's Trump in control. He was also a lot more boring and a lot less compelling, undoubtedly, to the people who really like him. And he couldn't keep it up. After those two speeches, people were talking about, look, this is Trump on a leash. The Republicans are starting to get him under control, and maybe we'll see what happens. Then he started, you know, and more recently he's been going off and ranting about Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas again and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, that lasted like 3 days. So Trump and you know, I'll be clear on my analysis at electiongraphs.com still shows Trump improving. In the last couple of poll updates I did there was one poll update that was favorable to Clinton, which was Utah. There have now been enough polls in Utah showing it close that I moved Utah into the weak Trump category where it's a potential Clinton pickup. I don't believe that'll actually happen, but it's within the realm of possibility now. But then there was another move with Trump getting stronger in Pennsylvania. And this is all the poll averages, of course. But the caveat I put on my posts on that, and by the way, there as of the time I'm recording this, there are a couple more state-level polls that have come out that I have not yet put into play here, including one showing Clinton ahead in Kansas, which would be absolutely stunning. But anyway, we'll see how my poll averages change for that. But the but state level polls always lag the lag the national polls, at least at this stage in the race. They get the difference becomes much more minor once we get towards the very end of the election, and there's so many polls coming out in so many states. But at this stage in the election, this kind of state-by-state analysis I do does lag a little bit when there's a change, because I'm doing the average over five polls, and even the most polled states, that five polls covers a few weeks. And in most states, we're talking a few months. So it takes a while for that to wash out. But anyway, the national polls, of course, showed Trump's bump and then him going down ever since. And so Trump has had a rough couple of weeks. You know, it's all his usual antics. But the difference is that now we're talking about not how his position is within the Republican Party. We're talking about how his position is nationally. And maybe he got a little bit of a bump out of clinching, but, you know, the trend back when the trend during the main part of the primary process was the more he opened his mouth, the less he was liked nationwide. And I think we're back into that mode right now. But meanwhile, you know, he's also doing some, let's call it crazy talk on process type stuff as well. Not just like, you know, your random racist comments or ranting about things or whatever, which, by the way, are all things that his base likes. The question is, does anybody else? But he's talking about raising money, as an example. Now, we all know that his whole shtick was that he was self-funded and didn't have to raise money, etc., during the primary process. He was raising money. He didn't actually put a lot of his own money into it. But that was his shtick. One of his things he was saying is he couldn't be bought because of that. But guess what? General elections cost a shit ton of money. The general estimate at this point is you need about $1 billion. And Clinton is well on her way to raising that. At this point in the process, 4 years ago, Romney was well on his way to raising that. Trump basically hadn't started. It was just a few weeks ago when he said, oh, okay, I guess I'll raise general election money. But he's now saying, because he's so far behind pace and he's having trouble fundraising, he's not getting, you know, money pouring in at the levels that, you know, Romney or McCain had. He's saying he doesn't need $1 billion. He needs a lot less than that. And there's not a lot of specificity there. I've heard $500 million thrown around instead of $1 billion, but maybe even less. And because so basically his tack is that, well, I get all the free attention that I don't need to do this anyway. Now, it seems like a lot of this is post hoc justification of the fact that he doesn't have the money. Like, if he was raising money hand over fist, he'd probably be really proud of that and talking about how much money he was raising. But he's not. So he's justifying that, well, he doesn't really need it. And the dynamics of how he gets attention, don't get me wrong, Trump's going to get attention, lots of attention, from here to November, pretty much no matter what. But it is different than it was during the primary process. and how Clinton competes for attention will be different, and how his rants go over will be different. Like, he may still get the airtime for the rally where he rants for an hour, but it may have a negative effect instead of a positive effect. And the other thing people are talking about it's early. I can't talk right now. Anyway, he is not committing to spend money on get out the vote. Yvonne has mentioned this before. When he does talk about spending money, he's talking about advertising and most likely national advertising. He's not talking about get out the vote efforts and databases and stuff like that. He said he doesn't need that. And, you know, he's not talking about supporting very much down ballot races. He's agreed to do a little bit of that, but not to the level that people usually do. And in many cases, they probably won't want him. So the RNC is sort of to some degree frustrated because, you know, the $1 billion is not just about the presidency. It's about the down ballot races as well and getting people to come out. And Donald Trump appears to not believe really in get out the vote efforts, but they tend to be actually quite important. That whole ground game thing that back in Iowa, he said, I didn't even know what a ground game was. Whatever. Also, it's where he's spending money. Trump is insisting that he's going to try to win California and New York. Now, if he did win California and New York, that would be absolutely seismic. But California and New York have both been polled quite a lot. California is, of course, the biggest electoral vote total in the country with 55 electoral votes. And Clinton's ahead by 19.6% in my average on election graphs right now. In New York, which is, I think, the third largest state behind, it's California, Texas, New York, I think, are the three biggest. If I'm remembering correctly. She's ahead by 23% there. But he's intending to spend a lot of money in those places, trying to flip them. And, okay. In any scenario where California and New York went to Trump, there would be a massive landslide anyway. It just seems like not the right place to be, you know, putting your efforts. You know, just looking at, again, I'm looking at electiongraphs.com, my site where I track all these stuff, these things. I recommend it to everybody. Go look. As of the moment, minus the couple of polls I haven't put in there so far, you know, look, there's 9, 10, about 11 states right now where it's looking kind of close, you know, and he's that's where to concentrate the effort. You know, he needs to be putting some defense in places like Georgia, Arizona, Colorado, Utah, Missouri, because he's ahead, but just barely. He needs to be aggressively going after the states where it's close, but Hillary is ahead, but just barely. That's Iowa, Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Nevada. Now, even if he won, if he win all of those Clinton close states, he would just barely be winning at this point. But that's where he has to be concentrating. You know, New York and California, really? Those are essentially lost causes for the Republicans. You know, absent something absolutely catastrophic and world-changing. And I understand it's sort of like, he's trying to exude confidence or something, but really, if he spends a lot of money in those states, most likely, he's just throwing money down the toilet. And the RNC is like slapping their heads. And what is he doing? we go back to this thing that we say every once in a while is, if Trump was intentionally trying to destroy the Republican Party, what the hell would he do differently than what he's doing? You know, it's like everything he does is, you're just, I don't even know what to say. I mean, he's not doing the smart things that you would expect him to do to try to win. Now, of course, Trump's argument is that he's different. It's completely different than regular elections, and he's not going to be bound by what people have done before. And okay, I understand that. And it's quite possible that his strategy is just a plain out national media strategy. You know, he doesn't care about helping the down ballot people at all. Maybe he's not even going to think about this state by state by state by state. He's just going to pour everything nationwide. I think that's the wrong approach, because you do end up wasting a lot of money or time or thought on places that aren't going to flip, whereas you could be a lot more targeted. But maybe that's his approach. And yeah. Meanwhile, because of all of this, you're having increased talk this week about dumping Trump at the convention. This is something that we talked a lot about in the time that it looked like he wasn't going to get to 1237 was a real possibility. Or maybe, you know, he would get there, but Cruz would still be really strong, and a lot of the Trump delegates didn't really support him, and so they would vote to unbind themselves, and then Cruz would win, or something like that. Now we're getting talk of, look how bad Trump is. It's getting worse and worse. He's declining in the polls, and, you know, can we get a move together to dump him at the convention? So what this would take is a rule change to unbind the delegates. By the normal procedure, how that would have to happen is the Rules Committee, which is about 100 and something teen delegates, I think. So around 120 delegates out of the convention are part of that Rules Committee. And they meet before the convention. They would have to agree to that rules change and then present that rules change to the convention, and then the majority of the delegates overall would have to approve it to unbind the delegates, and then the unbound delegates, of course, would then have to vote for somebody other than Trump. Now, there are probably parliamentary ways to put a rules change to the convention without having first gone through the Rules Committee, but that's probably even more challenging. So far, the people who are actually on the Rules Committee who have been speaking have said, not even on the table, we're not going there. And specifically, the Rules Committee includes a lot of Cruz people. And the people who were Cruz people or involved in the Cruz campaign, from the reports that I've read, seem to want absolutely nothing to do with an effort like this. Like, if it happens, they don't want their fingerprints on it. So I think this is a very unlikely thing at this point. But, you know, the one caveat there is if Trump continues to do badly and continues to go down and down and down in the national polls, and by the time we get to, you know, the week before the Republican National Convention, we see the polls showing an absolutely devastating Clinton landslide and Trump nowhere even close to being competitive, maybe the convention at that point could do something else. We know there are a bunch of quote-unquote Trump delegates who aren't really Trump people at the convention, but it would take the amount of risk that all of those people at the convention would take in order to overturn the primary results and pick somebody else, despite Trump having clearly won the primary caucus process, would be enormous. Most of the people at that convention are either politicians or wannabe politicians, and you know they would be taking what is clearly, if not a majority of the Republican Party, clearly the plurality of the Republican Party, probably around 40%, who are really strong Trump supporters. And you would be alienating those people and making them really, really, really angry. Not to mention making Trump angry, and who knows what kind of rants he would go on and how he would react to that. It would be a mess. It would almost certainly end up with the party in an even weaker position going into the general election than with Trump. Even if they picked, quote-unquote, somebody reasonable, somebody that was more appealing to the general election audience, they would be so damaged by that. And there would be so many Trump folks who would stay home. And yes, you'd please the maybe 60% of Republicans who kind of wish it wasn't Trump, but most of them are coming around and saying, yeah, okay, fine, Trump. But if that changes... If that changes, and by the time we get to the convention, it seems like, you know, most Republicans want to dump him, then maybe. This is not a scenario I'd bet on, but it's been talked about a lot this week. And, you know, part of that is, you know, I've said many times before that the media bias is not left or right. The media bias is towards exciting things. And so that's why for months and months and months after it was clear that Clinton was the winner. There were still breathless debates about Sanders and was this bad for Hillary? Does Sanders have a chance? Blah, 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 blah. For huge amounts of time after it was clear that Sanders was not going to win the nomination, we still had those debates. It's why right now, in the slow time between everybody getting their nominations and the convention, we're talking about things like, you know, can we still have a contested convention, please? Can we unbind the delegates and dump Trump? And, you know, there's some desperate never Trumpers who wish it would happen. But that doesn't make it likely. You know, Trump seems to be doing nicely at self-destructing. So if that process continues, who the hell knows? Before we wrap up, Veeps for Trump. I still keep hearing Gingrich, although Gingrich was very critical of Trump's comments about the judge. And I joked on Twitter that he must have been told by Trump that he wasn't going to be the Veep. But I still hear his name more than anybody else, even after that. And I honestly have no freaking idea what Trump is going to do. Who the hell knows what goes on in that man's head? He has said he's going to pick an experienced politician. Most of them have told him to go fuck himself. So he's got a limited number to choose from. We'll see. And this is going to be one of those places where, you know, you're going to see a lot of talk about how, you know, the decision of VP is the first major decision of a presidential candidate that shows what they would, you know, be like as president or whatever. And so that's why, you know, picking Sarah Palin really hurt McCain, for instance. You want to make a good choice. We'll see what Trump does. The one thing, though, that I will say is, like, you know, on the Democratic side with Clinton, you can see her picking somebody that will, you know, she'll make clear that they'll have a real strong position in the administration. They'll do this, they'll do that. But you could see Trump saying some of those things, but making it, but immediately sort of marginalizing that person and putting them to the side. And because Trump is the center of everything in Trump's world. And, you know, it's hard for, I think it would be really hard for him to really say, you know, this is going to be my true partner. And, you know, you're going to see them and you're going to see them a lot and they're going to be important in my administration or whatever. He may say some of those things, but my guess is his actions are going to show that, no, not really. You know, I mean, he has actually said I don't think it was him directly. It was like Manafort or one of his staff said in an interview at some point that Trump is looking for a vice president with government experience, elected experience, that can do the parts of the job that Trump doesn't want to do. And you can guess what that means. It means Trump wants to run around making bellicose statements and being president and flying around in Air Force One and getting the helicopters and all that kind of stuff, the fun stuff. But he wants no part of the nitty-gritty details of day-to-day being the president and making policy decisions and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. That's no fun. Who the hell wants to do that? So, you know, does he really want a vice president who will actually be the behind-the-scenes president who really makes the decisions, and he just wants to be a figurehead? Maybe, but even if that's what he wants, in the end, I can see during the campaign him treating his VP like shit. I mean, look at how he's treated Christie. And maybe Christie will be his VP. I don't know. You know, this is not a man who does well in sort of a cooperative type thing. I don't know. Anyway, since I talked about Stein a little bit on the Democratic side, I'll talk a little bit about Johnson here, I guess. There's some evidence that Johnson is taking Trump votes, Republicans who are dissatisfied with Trump going to Johnson. Very interestingly, in the last 24 hours before I'm recording this, Mitt Romney said he's not voting for Clinton, he's not voting for Trump, he's going to have to take a serious look at Johnson. Which is interesting. If you get people like Romney actually coming out and endorsing Johnson, that's the kind of thing that could potentially boost Johnson to the level that he's hitting the required 15% in the polls to be included in the debates. And if he's included in the debates, that changes everything. And you may actually get sort of a more Perot-ish scenario as opposed to your typical, you know, third parties get 1% kind of scenario. We'll see, though. This time in the cycle tends to be when third parties peak in the polls. So they may diminish before the end. But like I said when we were talking about the Democrats, this, if any year is going to be different, 2016 could be that year. So watch very carefully what is happening to Stein and Johnson, both in terms of polling, but also very critically in terms of press. Usually the third parties get an occasional throwaway story of, haha, go look at the third party. Isn't that cute that they exist? If you start seeing the press spending significant amount of time on them and talking about how, you know, people are you know, looking for the alternative to Clinton and Trump, then, you know, the more press, it's a cycle. You know, in order to get support, they have to get press. In order to get press, they have to get support. And so if you start seeing a flywheel effect start happening where, you know, oh, the polls are a little bit higher, so let's give them some more airtime. Oh, they got more airtime, which drives the polls higher. If you start seeing that kind of cycle happening, then that might be where you actually see third parties getting significant. I've mentioned in some of the back and forth on the Facebook pages for election graphs and Curmudgeon's Corner that, you know, my whole election graphs analysis of the Electoral College is based on, you know, your standard two-party race. I've sort of got in my head, what will I do if it looks like there's a serious chance that a third party will get electoral votes, or even if a third party will come in second in some states? But, you know, it basically involves a complete revamping of the site. And if that happens, I've said, yeah, I basically have to take a week off of work and change the site. And it's going to be a pain in my ass. But I will watch the third parties. And if they get to that point, I will do what I have to do. But, yeah, that'll be, yeah, a lot of work on my part. Anyway. I'm of mixed feelings of that, because of course it would make the race much, much more interesting, but it would be a hell of a lot of work. Anyway, enough of this. I need to take a break, and actually I'm at the point in the morning where I have to go do all my morning stuff, so I guess I'll come back and finish this up in the afternoon instead of finishing up in the morning. Well, that kind of sucks. I'm going to be really pushing up against my deadlines for getting this thing out. Sigh. Okay, that's it for this segment. We'll be back, and I'll talk about a few other random things. Not many. I could just leave that out. I could just leave that out and call it done. We'll see. Back after this.
Do you want to understand what is really going on with the presidential election cycle? Then go to electiongraphs.com right away. There you'll find charts and graphs covering the nomination processes in both parties and the general election race for electoral college votes. For the delegate races, we track not just delegate totals, but also the ever-important analysis of how each candidate has to do with the remaining delegates in order to actually win. For the Electoral College, we track state-by-state poll averages to categorize which states are actually in play and which are not, in order to show you the range of likely electoral results and how that changes over time. Sure, you can get some of this stuff elsewhere, but not in exactly the same way, and not from me, Sam, your prime curmudgeon. I think my election trackers are better than the rest, so come look at mine, electiongraphs.com.
Do, 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 do. Today, we're back on Samuel Podcast, right?
Curmudgeon's Corner.
No, but I'm calling it Sam's Podcast.
Okay.
Sam's watching Sam, and it's
listening.
His past.
Don't touch the cord.
And so, this is another YouTube Alex thing. AlexMxela.com. The dot is a period. And by Alex and Dad. You only need AlexMxela.com. That's how you get to my YouTube channel.
Yep, Alex Mxela. Or Alex Mxela. There we go.
And you can read it.
Gaming videos and more from Alex. Elementary school by day, YouTube by night.
Then my name of the YouTube channel again.
And what kinds of videos do you do on your channel?
I do the
Oh, it's a secret. Okay, you'll have to go to the channel to find out.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Alex. Can I do the rest of my show now? Okay. Bye.
No, you
dear
one. Because
okay.
It finally got 200.
Okay, bye. And now that Alex has had his say and a new game has downloaded for him, or a new chapter of an existing game, it's time for a lightning round. And a few little things here. One, I just thought it couldn't go the week without mentioning the Brock Turner case. They're at Stanford. The kid was convicted of sexual assault. and I don't know exactly the legal nuances between sexual assault and rape in this case, whether and exactly how we got to that conclusion. But bottom line is he was found he was found raping a unconscious woman behind a dumpster outside a party. And two passersby pulled him off, called the police, ended the situation. It went to court and, went through this whole process. The woman involved wrote a really impassioned letter to the guy that was read as part of the court proceedings. He ended up getting a 6-month sentence, whereas, the maximum sentence for the charges was obviously much, much longer. I don't have much to add to a lot of what's been said online about this. I just want to say I completely agree with the side of this that saying it's absolutely ridiculous. The people who are, saying things like, well, this is going to ruin his life and, we needed to give him this 6-month sentence because it could drastically affect the rest of his life and, just drunk kids, blah, blah, blah. And, him justifying him. This is all ridiculous. Yes, your life should be ruined. You raped somebody. And, I understand the people that say, hey, sometimes people get drunk and things happen and it's really nobody's fault, blah, 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 blah. And maybe there's some cases where you can properly argue that. This is not one of them. From all reports that I've read of this, the woman in question was in pretty bad shape. I mean, she was taken to the hospital. She had, whatever. This is not one of those cases that you could make that sort of argument in a plausible way that, both people were responsible, blah, 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 drinking, blah, 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 whatever. This is, I mentioned before a number of months ago we were talking about, I think it was the Matthew Keyes case where he was potentially going to serve a fairly long prison term for, a little online digital prank where he gave away the passwords to a newspaper and then somebody changed the headlines on the newspaper. And he is looking at more time in jail than this guy is. And that's ridiculous. And you need to have some sort of balance in these things. And right now we're way out of kilter. And just the notion, and some other people compared, hey, here's this, white guy had a swimming scholarship, was this, was that, had all this kind of potential, and he gets like a light sentence. You can find somebody else under very similar circumstances from a less privileged background, be it race, be it income, be it whatever, and they get locked up for much longer periods of time. And I'm not saying it's wrong that they get locked up for more time. More time is probably the right thing in these kinds of scenarios. But the fact that this guy gets off because his family is relatively well-to-do, he's going to a good school, he's, basically, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and the bottom line is it's because the judge can look at this kid and see himself and see, when I was a kid, I kind of looked like that. I had this thing. I got drunk sometimes. Things happen sometimes. Okay, this didn't happen. At least I hope it didn't for the judge. It's ridiculous. Anyway, if you haven't read the letter that the woman wrote, definitely go look for it. There's also a couple places where people have read it. And made videos. I guess it was Ashley Banfield did the one that I saw where she just took a significant portion of her show and read it. And that's the one I watched, and it was quite good. It was quite moving. It was like 20 minutes long, but it was, you couldn't turn it off. You start listening to it and you're like, wow. Anyway, that's it for that case. Okay, next up, Gawker filed for bankruptcy. A little while ago, the Hulk Hogan case got to its conclusion, and Hulk Hogan won, and won a very substantial sum. I forget exactly what it was. And it came out that Peter Thiel, billionaire, is on the board of Facebook, I believe, and other things, was bankrolling Hulk Hogan's attempt here. And apparently enough to send Gawker to bankruptcy, and they've already announced that they're being bought by Ziff Davis as part of that process. And the only thing to say here again is, first of all, it may well be true that Gawker passed some lines that they should have been punished for in a court of law for what they published about Hulk Hogan. Not necessarily that there was a story, but all of the details and the specific way they did it may have passed some of those lines. I honestly don't think it's enough for sort of a corporate death sentence where you're charging them enough that, you know, it makes the company go under. Because what is the troubling part here is whether Gawker passed those laws it's not as early as it was, but I'm still like, whatever. Anyway, it's not necessarily those specific lines that Gawker may have passed. The troubling part of this is the notion that if a journalistic enterprise pisses off the wrong person, in this case, it looks like Peter Thiel was the wrong person in question, that person can, through the legal system, just take actions that, put that company at risk. Whether or not they won this, they could have funded ongoing lawsuits to sort of harass and can keep them litigated. And I don't know. I think that it's hard to separate, because on the merits, Hulk Hogan may have been right in this case. I don't know enough of the details to say, but certainly a court of law thought that he was and awarded him a verdict. But what I worry about is not that specific case. It's, is there a chilling effect in general? Because, you do have the large mega media companies that have deep pockets and can spend lots of money fighting lawsuits, settling lawsuits, etc. But the sort of vital parts of the media landscape today are relatively small players who are not that big and who are newer and nimbler and taking advantage of new media and blah, blah, blah. And Gawker is one of those examples. I mean, Gawker's done a lot of, not just Gawker themselves, but their whole like stable of websites. Some of them are better than others, but a lot of them, it's not necessarily the poster boy of the best practices that you want out of journalists. They're not necessarily the best in terms of how they even treat their employees, things along those lines. But at the same time, you don't want things that make people think and double think and triple think before they publish stuff. You want a vital free press that is out there and pushing the limits and making people uncomfortable, because the job of the press is to say and do things that make people uncomfortable. It's to bring up the facts that nobody wants to be brought up. You know, that's what good journalists do. And I'm not necessarily saying Gawker is a good journalist in all cases here, or any cases even. No, they've done some good things too. But that's what you want out of the press. You want the press constantly aggravating everybody and, you know, exposing things that that the subjects don't want exposed. That's what the good press should be doing. And if this kind of thing puts a damper on that, then it's a negative effect. It's a negative effect overall. And I think we need to be very careful with that balance. Now, what's the answer to that? Do I suggest prohibiting certain kinds of lawsuits or whatever? No. That's not the right way to go. I don't know that I have an answer. I just worry about the trend because this kind of thing, you know, says, okay, well, you know, Gawker was annoying Peter Thiel and was annoying Hulk Hogan. And, you know, they were able to shut him down. Not just get, you know, sort of reasonable damages for something that was proven to be wrong that they did. No. It was more than that. It's okay. You got him shut up. Now there's a question of, yeah, I mean, they've been bought by Ziff Davis, like I said. So in some form, the Gawker websites will continue. Maybe not Gawker.com itself, but the rest of the stable might. And probably actually Gawker itself in some form. But it'll be a different form with different sort of management and priorities and things like that. So effectively, they got it shut down. And I'm not sure that's a good precedent. Oh, well, we'll see. Okay, a couple Apple and phone things just to note in passing. I'm not going to have a lot to say about these. Yet another study showing that iPhone users are keeping them longer before renewing. I know this is true for myself. In our family, we used to be essentially on a two-year cycle, and we've sort of slipped into 2.5 and maybe even 3 years. And it's honestly no longer, we're at the end of our cycle, we can upgrade. It's, is the phone dead yet? Or is it feeling problematic, which takes a little bit longer these days? So of course their sales are slowing down a bit because everybody has one. And if they're making them good or better than they were, you can wait a little bit longer between upgrades. And of course, if they come out with a new compelling must-have, oh my God, the new one does this and the old one doesn't, maybe that changes a little bit. But they haven't done that in a couple generations of the phone yet because it's been more incremental. So we'll see. I think the smartphone market, and this applies outside of Apple too, is becoming a somewhat mature market, at least in the U.S. and most quote-unquote developed countries. They've got a lot of room to grow, obviously, in the rest of the world still. But I think it's becoming a more mature market. They also announced, Apple did, some stuff with how they deal with subscriptions and opened a lot more things up to subscriptions than used to be. And I know they're addressing some developer concerns about how to monetize their stuff. Because a lot of developers, especially smaller developers, are finding it's just impossible to make money on the App Store these days. People are also downloading less apps than they used to. And I know for myself, you know, the first couple of years I had an iPhone, it was a daily routine to surf the App Store and look for something new and interesting to download. And almost every day I'd find one or two things and I'd download more stuff and I'd play with it. And, you know, I had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of apps on my phone. Now I do that much more rarely. And it's much more, sometimes I'll still go there because I'm bored and I'm like, I want to do something on my phone and nothing on there is getting my attention. So let me go look for something new. But I'd say just as often now, it's a trip that's fairly targeted. Like, I've heard about this specific thing that I want to check out. And most of the time, though, I find what I've got on my phone is fine. In fact, I've got more stuff on my phone than I need. And so, you know, I have got a handful of games I play and a handful of apps that I use multiple times a day. And for the most part, I'm like, I'm not hankering for something else. It's doing the things I want to do at the moment. So, but what I worry about with things like the subscription model and stuff is monetizing at the expense. Like, look, what I want as a consumer, I want to buy the app once and be done. I despise in-app purchases for most things. Well, especially games. The freemium game model just really pisses me off. and annoys me. And I'm like, I want to buy the game flat out and have everything unlocked. It's going to be unlocked. I have no interest whatsoever in the games that keep trying to get you to buy things every time you play or anything like that. Do not want. I wish that the option that said turn off in-app purchases in the preferences, I think it's actually in parental controls somewhere or something, required app developers to, if you've got that on, don't even show you the options to buy things. Having said that, there are a few reasonable uses of in-app purchases. Like, I have an app that has a bunch of features, but there are a few like sort of specialty features that not everybody needs, and that costs $2 more. That's okay. I can deal with that. I know one of the things that Apple hasn't done is do upgrade pricing. You have to create a new app. So like if you have, the one I use for Twitter, Tweetbot, was an example of this. They're now at Tweetbot 3, I think, or is it 4 now? I don't know. But they actually have to release a new app and sell it from scratch when they have a major upgrade if they want to get more money from it. And developers want to be able to have, you already have Tweetbot, click here to upgrade for $4 or whatever. And I can definitely see that. But subscriptions, I'm wary of. Like, would I want to convert my Twitter app, my Tweetbot, and instead of, paying $5 for it up front, or it was probably $2 or $3, I forget. Instead, if it was $1 a month, would I still want it for that particular app? Hell yeah, I'd pay $1 a month for that. I'd probably pay more for that. That's one of my primary apps that I use continuously all day long. But there are very few that would fit into that category. And so I worry about you sort of abuse of the subscription model. And I guess I shouldn't say abuse. I mean, supply and demand will tell you. But it'll be a crappy experience for users if everything becomes a pay-every-month sort of thing. There are quite a lot of these things where it's like, come on, I want to pay once and be done. Apple's guidelines have sort of certain types of things that are okay for subscriptions and certain ones that aren't. But I just worry it's going to go in a weird direction. But at the same time, look, I understand you app developers are having trouble figuring out good ways to monetize at this point, because everybody's now got the expectation that, apps are either free or at most like cost $1, that's tough if you're not doing the freemium game model. The only other Apple thing, and then I'm about to wrap this up, WWDC is next week. I'm not going to say anything about it until after WWDC when we see what they actually announce. There are all kinds of rumors, as there always are, but we'll talk about it afterwards once we know. And then one last thing to mention, and it's actually a thank you. I do the Curmudgeon's Corner podcast, and I also run electiongraphs.com. Just about 6 days ago, a week ago, I don't know, something like that, on sort of a whim, I added a tip jar to Election Graphs, simply because, honestly, Yvonne owed me a little bit for the advertising and stuff I run for Curmudgeon's Corner, and he paid me using PayPal. And I was like, oh yeah, PayPal exists. Let's see how hard it is to set up a tip jar. And it turned out to be really exceedingly easy. it took me, I had the basics up and running in 10 minutes, and then I spent, a little bit longer making it a little bit nicer. But even then, not that nice. If you go to my tip jar page, it looks old-fashioned and somewhat crappy, but, whatever. Anyway, I got my very first tip. And so I just wanted to thank David from Kirkland, Washington, who was my first tip on the Election Graph site. He donated a little bit to me. More than I expected. I honestly didn't expect to get any tips off this thing. I just thought it would be good to put it up there. But and he sent me a note saying it's obvious I put a lot of work into the site, and he finds it very interesting and useful. So thank you very much, David. I appreciate the tip. And, you know, hey, if anybody else out there wants to drop a tip to Election Graphs, feel free. Yeah, I don't expect to, you know, ever actually make any real money off that. It's a, it's as this podcast is, it's something I do because I have fun doing it. You know, it'd be nice to at least sort of recoup the, costs, for, hosting and advertising and stuff I put into these things. That would be awesome. I'm probably not going to recoup the time I put into it, which is extensive. But, you know, anyway, and as I hear all kinds of noise coming from the hallway, I guess I'll wrap it up. Thank you for joining me for yet another Curmudgeon's Corner. Hopefully, Yvonne Bo will be back with us next week, crossing my fingers that everything sort of goes well with him and his family this week. As usual, go to our Facebook page, Election Graphs on Facebook, and like us there if you haven't already. And even if you have, leave some comments. Tell us what you think about what's going on. And we love that sort of feedback. Hey, that's it. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.